Oral history interview on the 4th of April 2014 with Elizabeth Wells, archivist.
Harriet Costello, archives assistant.
And Nicholas Bevan.
Right. I wanted to talk a little bit actually about your family to start off with, because you're not the first in your family to have gone to Westminster School. Your grandfather, I understand, also went to the school. And I wondered when you were growing up whether you knew anything about his time at Westminster School.
Very little. My grandfather, Arthur, he was here in the 1890s, I think. And I didn't see much of him because he died when I was about 10. And I don't think I was even conscious that he'd been to Westminster. Because I was not destined for Westminster. I was destined for Bryanston, of all places. My older brother, who was 2 years older than me, was a sort of country-loving guy. And my parents thought that Bryanston would be good for him. And there was some family history with Bryanston, and they decided that I should go there as well. But that all began to fall apart at prep school, because David was 2 years older than me. We were in the same form. I was at the top of the form. He was at the bottom of the form. You can imagine the tensions which arose there. It was bad for him, it was bad for me. It wasn't that he was unintelligent, but he was dreamy. And he made up for it later in life. But he was totally non-academic, whereas I was, I suppose, a bit of a swot, and enjoyed learning, did well, and came top in everything. And so my parents very sensibly decided that we should not go to the same public school. And my father was the medical officer for Westminster, and thought, well, that's a good alternative. And although this was only about 2 years before I came, he managed to slip me onto the list somehow. And so David went to Bryanston and I came to Westminster. I wasn't conscious at the time that my grandpa had been here. My father wasn't here, he went to Harrow. And my great-uncle had been here. Peter Bevan, he was here, he must have been here in the 1920s, I should think. But again, I didn't know much about Westminster at all until I got here. So there wasn't really a family tradition that I was aware of.
And what were your first impressions of the school?
I took the challenge, hoping to get a scholarship, but I didn't. I got an exhibition, and I went to Busby's. And if you were a new boy at Busby's at the time, you had your first term at number 2 Barton Street, which was then run by Ted Craven, later, I think, housemaster of Ashburnham, and his wife, Dorothea, who was a very homely, motherly woman. And I think it was thought, and it was a very good idea, that small boys arriving in a big school for the first time, some of them perhaps hadn't been at boarding school before, should go somewhere where they were, it was more like home than being cast into the hurly-burly of a big dormitory in Busby's. So the first term was there. And then we moved into Busby's. I find it all rather intimidating. I'm sure it's quite different now, but in those days, you all slept in one large dormitory. Not all the boys in the house, but I mean, probably the junior 2 years were in the same big dormitory. So quite a lot of boys in one dormitory. There was a big room downstairs. You didn't have a desk of your own. You had a locker, I think. And then there was a big room with tables. That's where you did your prep. And there was a room upstairs with a billiard table in it, I think, where you could relax. I remember the ablutions were very primitive. There was a room with about 6 baths down each side, and no privacy at all. I'm sure that's changed now. And I was happy, but I was happier when I went into college, because I took the challenge again in the summer of my first year, and then I got a scholarship and went into college, which was suiting me better, really. because I was still a swot. I still liked my work. And in college, I was surrounded by boys with a similar disposition. And it was a happier experience. But I think for any boy coming into a school where there are 400 people that he doesn't know, it's a bit alarming. So I think I was a bit intimidated at first. I quite like Busby's. The housemaster was a little man called Francis Rawls. And like all these people, I find him very intimidating at first, but later in life when I got to know him, I thought he was charming and delightful and kind. But he never appeared like that at the time. And he ruled quite with a, I would say almost with a rod of iron in Busby's. He was certainly respected, and in some ways he was feared. But he was a very small man. I remember there was a tradition of Busby's house plays. And he was very keen on this, and he used to take part. And in one of the plays, he came on, he was playing a part of an insurance agent. And he came on, and he said, first line was, "My name is Samson." And of course, the whole of the house absolutely dissolved in laughter, because he was really a very small man, and the description just didn't fit. And whether he was amused by that or rather cross, I've never been absolutely sure. The other thing I remember about Busby's is that we had prayers every night, and at one stage, rather called prayer monitor or something. I had to go round just before prayers and tell everybody that it was time for prayers. And I had to go into every room and shout "Instant Preces," which is effectively the Latin for time for prayers, and then go and get the housemaster and bring him down. Why I was chosen for that, I don't know.
Aside from Rawls, are there any other masters that you particularly remember or you have...
I remember most of the masters who taught me. In our first year, I was in the form called 5 Alpha, which is effectively for the scholarship boys. And Ted Craven, again, he was our form master. And he was quite avuncular. I never got on with him enormously well. I remember later in life he used to teach us to write essays, and I've never quite forgiven him, because one day he said, out of the blue, "I want you all to write an essay. Imagine you're a member of parliament and you want to introduce a piece of legislation. So write a speech introducing your piece of legislation." Well, I didn't quite know what to do, and I thought for a few minutes. Then it was coming up to Guy Fawkes Night, and I decided that my piece of legislation would be to ban all private displays of fireworks and have just public ones. Not necessarily a particularly good idea, but that was what I thought I would do, so I wrote a speech to that effect. And I think probably the speech was excellent, but all I got from Ted Craven was criticism for being such a miserable fellow who wanted to spoil everybody's private enjoyment. And I thought, no, that's not the point. The point is whether this was a good essay or not, or a good speech. Mm. So I've always slightly held that against him. So he was there. We had... there was a master called David Simpson, who had been Master of the Queen's Scholars. And he taught us Latin, I think, in our first year. And later he was our form master in the... Classical Sixth, and he was quite a formidable man. He was elderly, he was bald, and he was fierce. He was a good teacher, but I was frightened of him, and he didn't let you off the hook, which was good. I mean, that's what you expect from a teacher, to really push you to your limit. But I find him a bit intimidating. Again, later in life. Charming man, very, very nice. Then, of course, there was Theo, Theo was Theo. I think anybody who has any knowledge of Westminster classics will know about Theo. He was a complete one-off. He was of Russian extraction. His parents had come to the UK before Theo was born, so just after the First World War, I guess. And Theo went to Charterhouse. And he just loved teaching, and he loved classics. And he was extremely good at Latin, Greek, Russian, probably one or two other languages which he never got around to. But he wasn't an ordinary sort of teacher. I mean, he inspired you, but he didn't concentrate on basics so much. He relied on somebody else to teach you the basics, and then he took you on from there. And we had, for basic teaching of Greek particularly, we had Dennis Moylan, who was an extremely good teacher, because he wasn't inspirational, but he made sure you knew all the basics. You get everything right. And I remember he taught us at A level, we were reading Aeschylus's Agamemnon, and I think we all did very well in the exam because he taught us so well. But he was quite fierce as well. He used to have a sort of rather like a swear box, and if you were late for a lesson, you had to put sixpence in it, or if you did some other misdemeanor during class, you had to put sixpence in it. And whoever put most sixpences in it could choose which charity the money went to. So it was all, it was benign. And the other thing I remember about him is that he always took, I think it was something called meloids, little tiny black pills for throat complaints, and he was always popping these into his mouth. But again, he was a benign man, but quite fierce. So he did the basics, and then Theo took us on from there. Theo was our form master in our second year, when we were in the shell, and he was a form master in our last 2 years, when it was the classical seventh. And so we saw an awful lot of Theo, and he got a lot of us into scholarships at university, because he was just such a good teacher. And he used to live... he had a flat at the back, right at the back end of college. And his whole life was devoted to Westminster. I mean, he would spend his evenings giving private lessons and so on. Very, very inspirational teacher. And I owe a lot to him. Certainly I owe it to him that I got a scholarship to Oxford. Anybody else? I mean, there were other teachers. There was Charles Keeley, who taught us history. I found him rather exotic, rather difficult, rather too clever for me. I think he was clever, but I was clever at classics as well. But I wasn't clever at history. So Charles Keeley he didn't just teach you the facts of history, which is what I was always interested in. But he went beyond that, which of course is a good thing, but I found that a bit tedious. Charles Fisher, Preedy Fisher, taught us maths. But I'm talking about people who only taught me in my first 2 years, because after 2 years we specialised, and after that it was just classics. We didn't do anything else. Not really. I mean, a bit of this and that, but nothing seriously. And the one criticism I have about my education is that we did not learn any science. I never learned any physics or chemistry or biology, nothing at all. And that's been a disadvantage to me in later life. I really regret that. That was a big mistake at the time, but I think they thought, well, if he's going to do classics, just do classics.
Was there still a sense of a hierarchy within the subjects, that classics was the top and science was...
Yes, very much so, yeah. We did a few periods of general science in our first year with Lawrence Bird. But to be honest, it was a complete waste of time. The only thing I remember about it was that he got some meat from the kitchens and we put it on the window ledges and let it go rotten, and watched what happened when flies laid eggs on it and developed into maggots and all of that. I mean, fascinating for small boys, but not really a tremendously good teaching aid.
Yeah. Do you remember any matrons? You spoke about kind of teaching.
Well, I remember the matron in college. That was Nita Hillary, who was the widow of a man who had been housemaster at Busby's, and I think had died relatively young. And she was very, how do I put this, well-bred. Not what you would normally expect in a matron, but she was more of a sort of person you'd go and see and you could tell her your troubles, which was nice.
Yeah.
She was a lovely lady. And she had a flat at the back of college, up at the top. The theatre was down below, she was up at the top. And I remember her very well. And I think some of her children and grandchildren came too.
Oh, okay.
I think Charles Lowe was her grandson.
Yes, that's right.
Mm. Now, she was a lovely lady. I got on very well with her. Because when I first came into college, John Carlton was the housemaster. Mm. And he was unmarried. So there was no female shoulder to cry on, so you know, it was Nita Hillary was the one you went to if you really felt unhappy.
Mm.
But that was my first year in college, and then he became headmaster, and Henry Christie came, and he of course was married, and his wife Nada was delightful, and you know, you could go to her as an alternative to Nita Hillary.
Yeah.
Not that I think many boys did, but there was always a time when you perhaps needed a bit of comfort.
Yeah.
Because in an all-male environment, boys can be pretty nasty to each other.
Mm.
And that happened from time to time.
What was the experience like when John Carlton became headmaster, being master of the scholars?
The previous headmaster was Walter Hamilton, and he was a big man, quite stout, with a very deep voice. That's the one thing you remember about him. He was really down the register. And I never had much contact with him. I mean, he was terrifying, actually. and he did teach me Greek for a while, which was a very worrying experience. But again, you know, he had a heart of gold, I'm sure. But he went off to be headmaster at Rugby, which everybody thought was an odd decision, to go from Westminster to Rugby. But he did anyway. And then John Carlton, known as Coote, of course, became the headmaster. I thought he was a very good headmaster. Other people have divergent views. But I thought he was good. I always got on very well with him. He was a very, very civilised man. Very erudite. And it was always a great joy and privilege to share a meal with him, which I did when I was captain of the school. And indeed he had a little tradition that in the summer holidays he would take the departing captain of the school and another boy on holiday, and he took me and a friend down through France to Switzerland, staying at all the best hotels, and then we went to stay in a sort of family chateau of his in near Vevey in Switzerland, and it was a wonderful experience.
Yeah.
He was a very nice man. I thought he was a good headmaster. He had the flat, which I think the headmaster no longer has, up at the top of number 17, Dean's Yard, looking out over. And he used to have a roof terrace up there. And it was lovely to go up there in the summer and have a drink with him and a chat.
Mm.
But he had a foul temper, actually.
Mm.
I remember once, he taught us English at one stage. It must have been my second year. And he didn't turn up for a lesson. And after about 20 minutes, we dispersed. And as we were dispersing, of course, he was coming the other way to give us a lesson. And I've never forgotten the fury with which he sent us back to the classroom.
Yeah.
What was discipline like within the school? Was it largely meted out by the monitors, or...?
Yes, I think it was really. There was quite a strong system of self-discipline, I put it that way. In college, we had was the captain of the Queen's Scholars and three others, and we maintained discipline. We didn't really have to refer very much elsewhere. And
was there a sense of that hierarchy beginning to break down during your time at the
school? No, I don't think so. Not at that stage. No, not at all. No. There was a sort of a general feeling of respect for senior boys. You're always going to have rebels, but in general the thing seemed to work. What was breaking down at the time was the system of fagging. When I arrived in Busby's, it was very much the practice. And I remember having to clean shoes and army boots for... I forget who it was for, but I remember having to do it, rather resenting it. And then, of course, when I reached the top of the school, I couldn't have a boy to do that for me. That didn't seem quite fair. You were constantly being sent on errands to post a letter or to go and buy something from the... There was a little shop in Tothill Street called the Fruit Basket. You can go buy a bar of chocolate or something from that if you didn't want to get from a tap shop, school shop. And I remember being sent. That I did send a boy when I was captain to do that, but he was deeply resentful. And I told him to keep the change, but it turned out to be only a halfpenny, so he didn't like me very much for that.
Did you enjoy being captain of the school?
Yes, I did.
What kind of responsibilities did you have?
Well, it's difficult to describe, but really basically running the house, making sure that everything ran smoothly, dealing with the discipline, talking to boys as much as possible. Because the college was a small house, only 40 boys, so you knew everybody quite well. I don't think it's the layout is now quite the same as it was then. But then, when you went up the steps from Little Dean's Yard, you came to a long corridor, and sort of immediately opposite you was the what was called the captain's box. That was where the captain, the Queen's Scholars, had his study. And then the corridor down to the right. And there were three or four, probably four, largish rooms off, in which there were a number of desks. And in each room, you'd have eight scholars. Probably, I think it was two from each of the elections, so you had boys of varying ages.
Right.
And that's where you sat and did your work. And the only boys who had studies to themselves were the senior boys. In their final year. And similarly, upstairs, there was a series of dormitories, and each election had one dormitory. And you all slept in the same room until your final year when you had a study of your own. And so it was in a sense sort of more open system. You perhaps got to know other boys better that way than I think everybody having their own study. But I guess nowadays everybody has their own study. I'm not sure I agree.
Not quite, actually.
Not quite. Good.
So the first eight scholars, the most junior eight scholars,
right,
are actually in together in one dormitory directly above this room.
Yeah.
Which we often hear, because we hear the sort of scaffolding and
yes.
The,
oh, right. Okay.
The jumping around.
Right.
So.
Yes. Well, of course, what you miss there is the system where people have their work desks in a big room with boys of varying ages.
Yes.
And that works rather well, I think. And then at the end, there was a room which was called the Frust Room. FRUSTRUM. Don't ask me why. Where there was a billiard table and books, and that's where you go and relax if you wanted to. And there wasn't a lot of space for relaxation. I mean, that was for all the boys in college, so it could get pretty full. And then there were stairs at the back of that, which went to the back of college, which is where Theo had his flat and Nita Hillary had hers. And then stairs up to the dormitory floor. And you walk. You had to walk through the dormitories or through the ablutions area, where there were a whole lot of... It wasn't quite as open as Busby's with the baths, but there were sort of two baths and then a partition and then two baths. That's how I remember how it was. And that may still be the same, I don't know. And then there was a back way from there into the Master of the Queen's Scholars House.
Was there commemoration during your time at the school? Did those sort of events take place?
Yes. Yes. I remember when you were a scholar, you were always involved in those things.
Mm.
I mean, as a scholar, you were obliged to be here for a certain number of Sundays during term time because you were part of the collegiate, whatever you call it, in the Abbey, so that you were part of the procession on a Sunday morning. So there needed to be at least, I think we had to have at least 16 of you every Sunday. And we, of course, had, I'm trying to think whether we had morning prayers in the Abbey every day. I rather think we did. Certainly, if you're a scholar, we had evening prayers in St. Faith's Chapel in the Abbey every evening, which was wonderful because you used to go to the Abbey after it was closed to the public and it was dark and just one or two lights to guide you round to St. Faith's Chapel. And it was always rather spooky. But it was a great privilege, and I always enjoyed that. And I don't know whether they do that every night now. I think they do it once a week or something like that. Yes.
Did all of the scholars identify as Church of England, or was there any non-conformism there?
I don't recall anybody not taking part in church activities. I don't know whether you had to subscribe. Perhaps you did. That didn't arise then. But I mean, for things like commem, obviously, you know, the scholars were heavily involved. We had a big commem every 4 years. We had a little commem every year, which was a much more intimate affair with just the Queen's Scholars in Henry the Seventh's Chapel and around the side of it, which was in a sense more fun. But when I was captain, it was the quattrocentenary year, so we had big celebrations for that. Although I remember that the Queen didn't come while I was captain, because that was the year when Prince Andrew was born, and she came later in the year, so she came
in the November.
In the November,
yes.
That's right. And I remember another effect of being out of commission was that, when it was the state opening of Parliament, or Westminster Boys, Queen's Scholars anyway, used to go and stand on the pavement. We had some privileged place so we could see the procession carriage go past. And the captain of the Queen's Scholars had a ticket for the Royal Gallery in the House of Lords to watch the procession. But I didn't go because the Queen didn't open Parliament that year because she was expecting a baby. And it was done by a commission, so there wasn't a great ceremony. So I missed out. But then, in my subsequent career in the House of Commons, I've been to more state openings than I care to remember. So I made up for it later. But yes, I mean, we were always involved in big ceremonies in the Abbey. There were services of various sorts, and we were always had to go and help the stewards with showing people to their seats and so on. I remember one time I had to show Lord Mountbatten to his seat, and then there was the occasion of Princess Margaret's wedding, when I think this was a little thing laid on by John Carton, because he was the headmaster at the time. I was captain, and David Mowring, who was my number two in college, and I were deputed to, at one stage during the ceremony, Princess Margaret and Lord Snowdon were kneeling on footstools, a little bit away from the high altar, and then those footstools had to be removed so that they can move forward to the altar. And David and I were deputed to be the guys who moved the footstools. And John Carlton, bless him, had us dressed up in court dress, knee breeches and the lot. I felt an awful fool at the time. And we had our pictures in the newspapers as quotes of the luckiest boys in London. And it was quite an interesting experience. Of course, I didn't realise that 40 years later I should be wearing that court dress on frequent occasions in the House of Commons. At least I knew, having worn it when I was 18, how to put it on.
Was there still a sense of disruption around the school buildings? Because they must have still been rebuilding school and the Busby Library following the...
Busby Library had been redone.
Mm.
I remember that because when it was decided that I should come to Westminster, my father brought me here and introduced me to John Carlton, because the hope was that I would get a scholarship and come into college. And he showed us round, and he showed us into the Busby Library, and he told us about it having been bombed and the ceiling having come down, and the new ceiling and the little birds that they'd put in, because the birds had been nesting there during the war. And when I came for my interview, the time of the challenge when I first took it, I remember we were in the Busby Library, and John Carlton asked me, "What do you think the date of this ceiling is?" And I thought, well, I knew that it was very recent, but am I supposed to say that, or should I show my knowledge of English decorative architecture and say that this was 18th century? So I said 18th century, and I think on reflection I should perhaps have said, well, it was put in there 2 years ago, sir. which would have shown that I'd at least listened to what he'd told me before.
Yeah.
And I think if I'd done that, I might have got the scholarship, because it was, John Carlton told me afterwards that they had a long discussion as to whether I should get the last scholarship or another boy, and they eventually gave it to another boy, and he admitted later that they got that wrong, because the other boy was a charming chap, but he wasn't particularly good academically, as it turned out. Anyway, that's history. School was still not in ruins. When I arrived, it had a temporary roof, and while I was here, they put the new roof on. But that was finished by the time I left. So school was out of commission for a while. Apart from that, I don't think there was any other building going on. No.
And it didn't feel particularly disruptive? Or?
No. No, it didn't. And Westminster Abbey was being certainly cleaned internally. A lot of scaffolding up. And there were times when we couldn't use it. I remember maybe it was because school couldn't be used. We had assemblies in St Margaret's occasionally. And we had church services round the corner in Graysmith Street, round the corner of the church around there. I forget what it's called. Yes, we used to go into St Margaret's.
Do you remember the food you used to eat here? Was it nice? Or
it wasn't brilliant. We took all our meals in College Hall.
Right.
Breakfast, lunch and supper. You have to bear in mind it's the 1950s. Food wasn't very exciting then. We got a lot of what we used to call sloppy meat.
Right.
Which was... not, I mean, it would be beef of some sort, or maybe pork or lamb, sliced extremely thinly, and put cold onto a plate with hot gravy poured over it, and that was pretty disgusting. The only time I remember getting decent food in College Hall was for election dinner, which they did do very well then.
Right.
But otherwise, I think the food was fairly dreary.
Yeah.
Not like it is now, I'm sure. But it was better than the food I got in my prep school. That's
really
certainly the case. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm.
talking about election, you went to Corpus Christi on an open scholarship rather
yes.
than, I assume at that point the school still had the closed scholarships at Trinity and Christchurch.
Yes, it did. Yeah, very much so. I went to Corpus because of the classics connection, really. Corpus was, it was rather like Westminster. I mean, classics was regarded at that time as the most important, prestigious subject to do. And that was the case at Corpus, just as it was at Westminster. All changed now, perfectly sensibly. And Theo, he knew the dons at Corpus, and he thought it was a small college, he thought it would suit me. And so I went in for Corpus. It's a strange thing looking back, having got my scholarship to Corpus. I think these days I would have left the school and gone and done something else for 9 months or whatever it was. But that never occurred to me at the time, and it never occurred to anybody else, and we all stayed on. Quite a lot of my colleagues in college got scholarships. And we just stayed on till the end of the summer term. It's madness, really. But it was very nice, I mean, because you'd got your scholarship, you could relax, you could do all sorts of things. And we did Latin play, for example, that year, and I took a leading role in that, which was good for me. I enjoyed it. It showed me that I could do something I hadn't thought I could do. Corpus seemed... It was a natural progression for me. I didn't want to go to Christchurch. It was enormous and full of Etonians. Not my sort of school at all, my college at all.
Did you keep in touch with many of the friends that you'd made at Westminster after leaving?
One or two, and I still see them, but it is only one or two. I do come back for college reunions occasionally. They don't often coincide with my free diary, but I come when I can. And I occasionally come to Elizabethan club dinners. And I meet people who I've known here, and I enjoy seeing them. But I think my closer friends are from university rather than from school. But certainly there are a couple from school who I still see on a regular basis.
Did any of your contemporaries, when you were at the school, leave a strong impression? The people you've sort of watched in later life, careers develop? Or...
Well, there are one or two people who have surprised me, as it were, because I wasn't expecting them to be important people later on. And I think that's probably true with a lot of boys at school. They develop later. Yeah, but there are people who I see, you know, in public life of one sort or another, who I wouldn't have expected at the time. Probably better not to name names.
Did you find it... I mean, you said that the college was a very natural fit for you, but did you find it academically stimulating going on to university after Westminster?
Yes, very. It was a sort of seamless transition. We were... doing with Theo, we were doing university's work effectively, university standard work here, and it just went on from that. And I mean, I was good at classics, languages, so I read greats, I did well in mods, didn't do quite so well in the second half because I found the philosophy particularly rather difficult. And so I got what I expected to get in my finals, which was a second. And my history tutor said to me afterwards, you were quite right in what you thought you would get, and you will find that the ability to predict that sort of thing accurately is very much more useful to you in later life than if you'd got a first. And he was right.
What did you do after Corpus Christi?
I went into the civil service. Not, I think, out of any great conviction that there was something I wanted to do. But what happened was that when you came towards the end of your time at Oxford, you had to decide. And the first people who actually came to you to say, join us, were civil service. And the civil service exam started in, I think, January of my final year at Oxford. So I thought, well, I'll try that. Mm. And if I get in, I'll think whether I want to take it or not. If I don't get in, I'll have to think of something else. Well, then I got in, and it became just too difficult to think of anything else. And I was quite happy with the thought of civil service. It was, I think, slightly different in those days. The idea of public service, once I'd thought about it, was attractive. So I thought, yes, that's something I want to do. I wasn't particularly motivated to go into industry. I had did have a provisional arrangement to become a solicitor. I would have been articled to a firm in the City of London, which would have been, looking back, quite good news financially, but I'm not sure I would have enjoyed it. Mm. I had a good career in civil service. I had jobs which suited my talents. I enjoyed it. I think I made a contribution. And then at the end, I had 10 years working in the House of Commons, which for me was sort of icing on the cake, really, because it really was a job which suited me. And I enjoyed that enormously.
Was it nice to return, you know, just across the road?
Well, it was, really. Having been educated at Westminster and then worked in Whitehall, to return to Westminster in a slightly different guise was rather satisfactory. And I remember saying to the Speaker's chaplain, who was a canon of Westminster, that, of course, the only thing I haven't done is the church. And he said, no hope of that, Nicholas. But actually, funnily enough, after I retired from the House of Commons, I did become a governor of the Abbey Choir School for 5 years. So that gave me the sort of church end of it.
Yeah.
But yes, it was rather nice. It sort of brought my professional life to a nice conclusion. Mm-hmm. Start at Westminster, finish at Westminster. Yeah, I like that. And I did enjoy the connections between the House of Commons and Westminster. Obviously, particularly with St Margaret's, which is Parliament's church. But we were quite often in the Abbey as well for bigger occasions.
Mm. Is there anything you'd like to say that we haven't given you an opportunity to say?
Let me just jot one or two things down on my way here this morning. I think I've probably covered them all. Yes, I mean, the only other thing to say is that, I mean, Westminster at the time was a boys' school, very much so. And the thought of, I mean, nobody had any thought of having girls anywhere near the place. And it was the same at Corpus. I mean, that was very much a male college. The doors were locked at 9 o'clock at night. If you were later than that, you had to climb in.
Gosh.
Yes, gosh is the word. I mean, that was extraordinary when you look back. And if you were caught with a girl in your room overnight, that was it, you were out. Yeah. And I don't think any of my contemporaries were. I suppose looking back, there are pros and cons of that sort of system. But I think young folk now are more fortunate than we were. I think it's a good thing for boys and girls to be educated together. And I think it's a good thing for colleges like Corpus to take women as well as men. I think it leads to a better outlook on life.
Mm.
But it stopped us being distracted. We're just able to concentrate on our work.
Yeah.
Yes. No, I mean, looking back, I mean, I'm very conscious of having been enormously privileged to have been educated at Westminster. I enjoyed it. I did well here. I was incidentally captain of shooting, as well as captain of the school, and which is why I wanted to go and see what was happening in Ashburnham Garden, which is where we used to have our rifle range.
I see.
And I enjoyed that aspect of it as well. We had a combined cadet force here, we used to call it the Corps, which we all had to join. And I found that a bit tedious. That wasn't my scene at all. And I, as soon as I could, I went into the Royal Air Force section of it, which was run by Geoffrey Shepherd, who was a very nice, rather relaxed teacher of modern languages. And he and I think, had rather the same outlook on discipline. And we rather enjoyed not being, the phrase would be too gutty, I think. Not too enthusiastic about the military aspects of it. But it was fun being in the Air Force section, because you could go and visit Air Force stations, and I remember we used to go out to White Waltham near Maidenhead and fly, be taken up flying in chipmunks and doing aerobatics and things. Wonderful for a 17, 18-year-old. Mm. Wouldn't like to do it now, but it was fun at the time. I remember we went to camp in Germany. That was interesting. We were going down a coal mine. Why that was part of it, I don't know, but I remember going down this coal mine and being made to crawl along a coal face, which can't have been more than 3 feet high. And it was must have been about 100 yards long. And I think I'm a slight sufferer of claustrophobia, and halfway through I certainly started to feel a bit uncomfortable, but I managed to make it. Mm. The other thing I remember about Westminster was school trips to Greece. I went twice, and they were run by Theo Zinn and Ted Craven. And the first time was when I was 15, and we went by train. And it was train from Ostend to Athens in the same carriage, which you can't do now. And 3 nights, sitting up. Great fun, wonderful experience. And then going all around the sites in Greece. And then on the way back, because you had to train through Yugoslavia, which was then a communist country, you had to have a transit visa. And we all had what we call double transit visas, which took you through one way and then back the other way. One of the boys had been given a single transit visa. And when we reached the Yugoslav border on the way back from Greece, the officials wouldn't let him in. And they took him off the train. And there's this 15-year-old boy, in the charge of Theo and Ted, being removed. And Theo, quite rightly, said, "I have got to go get off with him." And I remember that the officials wouldn't let him off. And Theo delivered this great punch to this official to get him out of his way. I'm surprised he wasn't had up for assault. But the official was so surprised, he sort of stood back, and Theo jumped onto the platform.
Yeah.
And then, of course, had to go back with the boy to Thessalonica and get a new transit visa.
Gosh.
But it's all very dramatic for her.
Yeah.
So now I remember Ted Craven, who stayed on the train with us, throwing a roll of banknotes out to Theo so that he had some money to...
Yeah.
it was an exciting experience. I mean.
Yeah.
Now, apart from that, I can't think of anything else that I need to say that you haven't covered. Probably on my way home, I'll think of all sorts of important things. That's the way of it.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.